Special elections, school safety, March for Our Lives, and the VA secretary ouster. Just some of the headlines we were watching this week. It's time to go deeper on Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At the roundtable this week, it's Rick Essenberg, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Rick, welcome back.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me. And Ed Fallone is here. He is an associate professor of law at Marquette University. Ed, welcome back to you.
Good morning, Kate. Good morning, Rick.
We've got the legal team in the house this morning. Well, let's start with special elections. The back and forth seems to have subsided now, with Governor Walker announcing that June 12th is the special election date for vacant seats in the 1st Senate and 42nd Assembly districts. The governor weighed in on the special elections on WTMJ. Let's take a listen.
2 days before nomination papers are due for the special election, people will be taking them out for the fall, and the special election will be held 12 days after nomination papers are due for the fall. So people will be running for a spot at the same time they'll be running for the fall election. That's why this is meaningless. The legislature will be adjourned. It is a waste of the taxpayers' money. And frankly, if I lived in those districts, I'd say forget about running in the special. Let's just focus on the fall when it actually means something.
All right. Well, Rick, what do you think of that? Is the governor right here?
Well, I think by way of the fireside equities, the governor has a point in that it makes little sense to hold an election on June 12th for a seat that will be on the ballot again in November, particularly given the fact that it is almost certain that the legislature will not be in session. I think that's so even had he called the election when the vacancy first occurred, because we probably would be having that special election about now. Mm-hmm. And the legislature, I think, has maybe about another week to go before session ends. So I understand the practical concern. The difficulty is the statute says what it says. And it's very, very difficult, I think, to argue that it was permissible to wait this long to call for a special election. The solution for that going forward, if we think that the governor needs more leeway in filling these vacancies, is to amend the statute, although I'm glad that the legislature didn't go ahead with the proposal that was floated, I think, last week or earlier this week, because that proposal, I think, was far too geared to this particular circumstance. And I think if we're going to amend the special election law, we should do it in light of what makes most sense going forward and not as a sort of a vehicle for unraveling this particular situation. So, I'm sympathetic to his concerns, but I'm glad that they stood down. I think this is, given what the law says, this is the way it should go.
Well, looking here for another legal opinion as well, Ed, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said Thursday morning, which seems like a long time now from Friday morning, but that's the world we live in, he couldn't take it to the floor at this time and that a judge would slap it down. What do you make of the Majority Leader's point there?
Well, I think this is not just a matter of conceding that the Republicans are in a difficult position. I think we need to come right out and say it. It's wrong on a matter of principle to deny people representation. This country was founded on the idea that we all have a right to representation in our government and have our voices represented by people we elect. It was blatantly self-serving for Governor Walker to drag his feet because he's made prompt special election calls in the past. What was different this time was that he expected Democrats to win, and for that reason alone, he was dragging his feet. The legal arguments that were mustered in support were ridiculous. They were mocked by three different judges. The most recent judge, Judge Neese, said that representative government and the election of our representatives are never unnecessary and never a waste of taxpayer resources. and the calling of special elections is required by law without any argument that it might be not practical or too expensive. The fact of the matter is, if the governor had acted promptly, we'd be having these special elections April 3rd. And I think the proof of the utility of this is we're talking about, well, you know, should there be a special session to amend the statute? If the governor had acted promptly, the people in these districts would actually have representatives during that special session to discuss the issue. And because these elections were delayed, if a special session were called to amend the law, these individuals in these districts would have zero representation. So this was totally without justification by the governor. He was held to national ridicule for this and struck down by three judges, rightly so.
Well, John called in from Eau Claire. John called 800-642-1234 to get in on this Week in Review conversation. John thinks Governor Walker's repeated concern about the cost of a special election is a bogus claim. He thinks it's more likely that the governor was concerned that Democrats would repeat the success they had in the 10th Senate District when Patty Shockner beat Republican Adam Jarko. So, Rick, let's start with you. What is your takeaway from what you saw happen this week? Is there a need for changes in special election law in the future? Where do we go from here?
Well, so I don't agree with sort of this the breathlessness about, you know, this being some fundamental blow against representative democracy. It's always the case when a vacancy occurs that there will be a period of time within which that vacancy is not filled. In fact, our statutes currently say that if the vacancy occurs after the date of the spring election, then the seat is up that fall. A special election need not be held unless a special session is already scheduled. And so this notion that we have to hold in all cases the election as soon as possible, or we have some fundamental violation of principle in the Constitution, I think is wrong. I think that there's room for a more pragmatic and practical approach. But that pragmatic and practical approach has to be set forth in the statute. And the statute as it exists today, I think, cannot be reasonably read to defer a call for a special election for a vacancy that occurs in December until the time of the regular election in November. And so I think the government's statutory interpretation argument was incorrect. I think the court's got it right. I think if we want to push back the date after which a special election need not be held, that has to be done by statute. There's some limit, I think, some constitutional limit as to how long you can allow a vacancy to exist. I don't know what it is, but that has to be dealt with by law. And I think the governor was wrong in this particular instance in not calling the election. But I will also say that both sides had their political motivations. The Democrats thought that they could pick off a seat in a special election. The Republicans didn't want to let them do that. I think we need to step back from the political motivation of whose ox is being gored by this particular circumstance and decide how we want these things to be handled going forward. Do we want them to be changed or do we not?
And Ed, I'll leave it with you here. Is it time for a refresh of a statute here, or did you see a fundamental blow against representative democracy this week?
Well, I don't know if it was a fundamental blow, but I think, Rick even began by denying there's any constitutional command for prompt elections, but then circled back around and admitted that the Constitution requires elections to be held. I think that the statute is clear as it's written. It provides for a realistic maximum amount of time that districts might be unrepresented. It never allows for a two-year period or almost two-year period of lack of representation, which was the absurd interpretation pushed by the governor and the state attorney general. And I think what really is the takeaway here is not that the statute is inadequate. I think the takeaway is that there's always been a belief that people on both sides in good faith supported the idea of holding elections and having representatives elected fairly and promptly, that the voting process, both sides had a stake in fair elections. And I think really the good faith of the Republican Party in the state in the aftermath of voter ID and the gerrymandering of districts and this kind of blatant politicized decision by the governor, I think the good faith of the Republicans in the state is really called into question. Do they really believe that voting should be a fair process, or have they totally weaponized the idea of elections? And that makes it extremely difficult now if you can't trust people to just follow the law as written.
Well, let's wind up this conversation with Andy joining us from Green Bay. Andy, your thoughts, your insights. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I teach leadership. This is the issue that I think we're facing, not only here in Wisconsin, but also nationally. I did a little survey in my class yesterday of leadership graduate students, and I said to them, let me ask you a question. How many of you trust our leadership in politics? And not one single student raised their hand. When we have federal judges saying, this is not right, this is wrong, this is against the law, this is not constitutional, the fact of the matter is it echoes a broader issue. We do not trust our politicians, and this is a great example of why we don't.
An erosion of public trust. Andy, thanks for your thoughts. You are with us on Week in Review on this 30th of March, working through a series of developments this week. Here's what's on our docket with Ed Filone and Rick Essenberg, getting your takeaway from the March for Our Lives rallies in Wisconsin and around the country. What do you hope will come out of it? Do you support President Trump's decision to fire the Veterans Affairs Secretary? And from Veterans Affairs Secretary said he's not for privatization of the VA. Do you agree, or would privatization be a step in the right direction? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're with Ed Filone, Associate Professor at Law at Marquette, Rick Essenberg, President General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. We'll be right back in a moment for more Week in Review here on the Ideas Network. On a Friday, it's Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're diving into the details behind the headlines with two guests from different political perspectives. Rick Essenberg is President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Ed Filone with us as well, an Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University. Your thoughts on the week's developments? Join the roundtable, 800-642-1234. What was your takeaway from the March of Our Lives rallies in Wisconsin and around the country? Do you think it will go anywhere? Do you think President Trump's decision to fire the Veterans Affairs Secretary was the right decision? And what about the Commerce Department's decision to add a citizenship status question to the 2020 census? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us WPR Mornings. So in the wake of recent school shootings, a special session on how to make schools safer here in Wisconsin, it culminated with the signing of a $100 million school safety measure by Governor Walker. The signing happened Monday. It would allow schools to apply for more money to ramp up security. Here's the governor.
The grants can be used both for physical changes to improve the infrastructure to address safety issues, as well as things like school safety officers.
So, Ed, does that go far enough, this grant system?
Well, the answer is no, it doesn't go far enough. I have no opposition to the bill. I think that most people would support money being available for physical improvements to schools to increase safety at entranceways. Most people would support additional money for the hiring of safety officers to patrol the schools. That's all well and good. The concern is calling this a school safety bill and not addressing the elephant in the room, which is gun control measures. And I fear that this is an effort to recognize the momentum, the energy of these marches demanding gun reform, and to divert that energy in a different direction and to replace their objectives, which are sensible gun reform laws, which the majority of Americans support. The majority of Americans support universal background checks on guns. The majority of Americans support a ban on assault weapons, to divert the attention and change the subject to these ancillary issues, which are fine and helpful and improve the situation, but really don't do the whole job.
So, Rick, does this measure, this $100 million school safety package, does it divert from the bigger issue in play here?
Well, I don't know that it diverts from the big issue in play here. I mean,
Second Amendment, right.
It is. Yeah, I mean, I think it is what it is. Now, when we talk about gun control measures, it seems to me that every time I'm on this show, we talk about gun control measures, and I say the same thing. That is that we're not having a serious conversation unless we make the discussion concrete. That is, what particular gun control measures do you want to enact? To talk about banning assault weapons is sort of a meaningless statement unless you start to define what an assault weapon actually is. And it turns out that when you start to do that, you find out that most of the things that you might potentially do would have very little impact on any of these rare but horrific mass shootings. Doesn't mean you can't have the conversation. You can talk about bump stocks. You can talk about magazine capacity. But that's the type of granular conversation that we should have. We can talk about universal background checks. At that point, some point in that conversation, you're going to have to discuss how it is that you're going to implement a system of universal background checks that governs private sales. We have background checks which apply essentially to any sale that the registered gun dealer makes. To anybody, whether that happens in a gun shop or whether it happens on a gun show. We have some difficulty or perhaps a lapse in the law in extending those background checks to private sales. That's a conversation that we can have. But one of the things that's frustrating about this debate, and it was to some extent frustrating aspect of this march, although I don't expect marches to be set forth detailed policy propositions, is that the conversation is very general, and a lot of it revolves around something, getting rid of guns, which we probably can't do politically, we can't do constitutionally, and we can't do practically because there's simply too many of them in circulation. And so we have to have a more particularized conversation of specific proposals. And I don't think that this bill necessarily, it certainly doesn't embody that conversation or embody those reforms, but I don't think it precludes them either.
Well, the conversation is going to get really interesting here, having two attorneys on Week in Review, an opinion piece written by retired U.S. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens said demonstrations by these school children and their supporters, quote, demand our respect. He went on to write that the support is a clear sign for elected officials to not only push for gun control legislation, but also repeal of the Second Amendment. And then President Trump shot back on Twitter saying the Second Amendment will never be repealed. As much as Democrats would like to see this happen, and despite the words yesterday of former Supreme Court Justice Stevens, no way, we need more Republicans in 2018 and must always hold the Supreme Court. So, Ed, what do you make of this back and forth and of the opinion piece by the former Supreme Court Justice?
Well, I am a fan of Justice Stevens, the former Supreme Court Justice. He was an excellent justice, and he makes some good points, in particular how the Heller decision recognizing an individual right under the Second Amendment was misguided and an example of fake originalist analysis. I agree with that. I disagree with the call to repeal the Second Amendment, and I disagree for two reasons. The first is amending the Constitution is a very long and difficult process, and to me that's sort of like saying we have an emergency, let's adopt a 30-year plan to solve it. The second objection I have is that, you know, we don't need to ban all possession of handguns. We don't need to ban all possession of firearms. What we need are sensible gun control laws. And I think, unfortunately, talking about repealing the Second Amendment kind of puts us into this binary argument of banning all weapons or permitting all weapons, and that's not the solution here.
And the word sensible comes up a lot, but the word sensible has many different applications to many different people.
I think, you know, where I disagree with Rick on this fairly strongly is it's not about starting a conversation among the public. What we have is we've got plenty of draft bills out there that already make proposals, sensible middle-of-the-road proposals for background checks being expanded, for bans on assault weapons, you know, based on their capability, you know, how many rounds can be fired, et cetera. What these marchers are demanding and where the momentum is building is let these bills come to the floor of the state legislature. Let these bills come to the floor of Congress. That's how you start the debate. That's how you figure out if amendments or clarifications are needed. That's how the process towards sensible gun control takes place. Not like, you know, not Rick demanding that we all hash this out in the public sphere before anything happens. But bills are out there. Let's get going here.
So, Rick, did Justice Stevens have insights? Would you call it dramatic? Was there something that you gleaned from it?
Well, no. In response to Ed, I'm not saying that the conversation should be limited to the public. I'm perfectly happy to see these proposals debated in the legislature. But when we are having a public conversation, as we are right now, and we are urging that there either be gun control or there not be gun control, I think it's incumbent upon us to be clear about what we're talking about. And I think to the extent that that we're not clear and we're not specific, we don't move the ball forward at all. And with respect to Justice Stevens, you know, there was a great deal of scholarship on the original understanding of the Second Amendment that took place in late 80s and early 90s and just past the turn of the century. Ed may not like that scholarship, but many, many people found it persuasive. And the Heller decision came to the conclusion that the Second Amendment simply didn't establish the right for states to have militias, but for persons to own guns in connection with the establishment of a militia, but to own guns as part of an individual right of self-defense. Now, Heller also made clear that that right was not unlimited. And so, in this sense, I agree with Ed that to the extent that the Second Amendment is pertinent here, it's pertinent in identifying the scope that Congress and state legislatures have for legislation. But to call for repeal of the Second Amendment, it seems to me, is futile. Even if you think it's a good idea, it simply isn't going to happen. And we live in a country where there are, I think, something in the order of 300 million guns in circulation. And it's unlikely that that's going to change anytime soon. And so I think that, to talk about repealing the Second Amendment, to talk about confiscation of guns, to talk about a gun-free society in the United States is to talk about things that are never going to happen. And I think that we have to have a far more prosaic conversation and, yes, debate in the legislature of particular proposals.
And let's take Rick now, joining us from Park Falls on this issue. Rick, what's on your mind?
Good morning. I wanted to state that I think one of the big problems here is that we have a riot of different and often conflicting gun control laws in America. It's been estimated that we have 20,000 different gun control laws in America. When you're talking about city, county, state, local, federal, I think it would be a great idea to repeal almost all of these gun control laws, because then we could settle down on what principles we really wanted to have in this subject. And to give you an example, the Thompson machine gun is over 100 years old. It's an antique. When is the last time you've ever heard of anybody being shot with a Tommy gun?
So Rick is saying, start from scratch. We are in Week in Review here. It is the 30th of March, and we're delving into the issues of the week. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. We're going to need to be moving on here. So many things to get to on this Week in Review. Certainly, do you support President Trump's decision to fire the Veterans Affairs Secretary this week? Former Veterans Affairs Secretary said he's not for privatization of the VA. Do you agree, or would privatization be a step in the right direction? What about the Commerce Department's decision to add a citizenship status question to the 2020 census? And then adult film star Stormy Daniels made headlines this week after her 60 Minutes interview. She offered details about her alleged affair with the president. Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So let's move on to national news this week with the VA. President Trump announced on Twitter he was nominating his personal doctor, Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson, to replace Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, David Shulkin. Shulkin told NPR that there are forces within the Trump administration seeking privatization of the VA, something he is against. Those forces maybe have played into the role in why Shulkin says he wasn't allowed to set the record straight on an ethics controversy or use funds on a trip to Europe.
There was nothing improper about this trip, and I was not allowed to put up an official statement or to even respond to this by the White House. I think that this was really just being used in a political context to try to make sure that I wasn't as effective as a leader moving forward.
So, Ed, are you surprised by Shulkin's response after he was fired?
Well, I don't know if I'm surprised. As always, with the Trump administration, any action that's taken raises multiple concerns, and you have to sift through to find out what's the real problem here. I think in the Veterans Administration, you know, one initial concern in this ouster is the replacement, Dr. Ronnie Jackson, and whether he has the qualifications and expertise to run the second largest bureaucracy in the federal government, over $200 billion in budget, and second only to the Pentagon in size. Another issue is the circumstances of the firing of Shulkin. Was it truly justified, or was it, as has been alleged, a political move to oust him because of his policy positions? And then I think what Shulkin is trying to say is that the real issue here is that there's a behind-the-scenes movement to largely privatize veterans' medical care and privatize the services of the Veterans Administration so that the veterans' hospitals and doctors themselves will no longer be the primary caregivers, but rather that the federal government will pay for private medical services. And that raises a lot of questions. That veterans don't want that program. It would be expensive for what you get instead of the government providing services. Now outside contractors provide it, most likely at a higher cost. And you have real questions of favoritism, you know, who gets these contracts and the corruption and favoritism that comes with that. So I think that Shulkin is trying to warn the public and generate discussion on the broader issue here, which is there something going on in the Veterans Department to basically privatize those services? Is it something we want? And let the public get in on this decision instead of having these decisions made behind closed doors.
Well, Charlie called from Edgerton, couldn't stay with us. He gets some of his health care from the VA and some from private care doctors. He's against the privatization of the VA, though he does see some sense in offering private care or services for veterans who live in rural communities that are far away from a VA clinic. So, Rick, what do you make of this firing and hiring this week of the Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson?
Well, there was an Inspector General's report upon which this dismissal was supposedly based. I can't claim to be an expert on what's inside of it. Apparently, the secretary went on a trip. He vacationed. He took his wife. He had the department pay for it. At least at first blush, that seems improper. I don't know that it's a firing offense, and there may be some circumstances that rendered it justified. With respect to the whole question of privatization, I think I know a lot about some things, but I would never want to suggest that I'm an expert on the provision of medical care to veterans. I think I can say, however, that the notion that privatization is some type of hobgoblin and will necessarily result in higher costs or somehow more likely to result in political favoritism, I think is a point that's oversold. Privatization often results in lower costs, and it is, in fact, the way that many services are delivered. I mean, everybody tends to agree that Medicare is although it has financial challenges, is a pretty successful way of providing health care to senior citizens, and it's generally a privatized program. Whether that makes sense to have more privatization in veterans hospitals is something that I don't know the answer to. I don't think it's an implausible proposition. It might work. Certainly, we've had some very high-profile stories about the failure of veterans' medical care recently. I would not reject it out of hand, or suggest that because someone is considering privatization, that there must be some type of skullduggery going on.
Let's bring in James here in Ironwood, Michigan, who has some firsthand experience in this. James, your thoughts.
Good morning. I'm a disabled veteran, and I spent a lot of time in and out of VA hospitals. I was fortunate enough initially to be going to one of their premier hospitals in Long Beach, California. But a lot of patients there talked about some of the horrible conditions in some of the other hospitals. Currently, I live in Ironwood, and I can walk to the local clinic. But when I lived in Nevada, I was lived in a very remote area, and the Veterans Administration had a contract with the local hospital. And the very fact that all I had to do is drive a couple of miles instead of 120 miles to Salt Lake City or Las Vegas was great. Like I said, currently I can walk to my current clinic, but there's other people in the Upper Peninsula that the clinic is 35, 40 miles away, and privatizing a hospital local to them on a contract would be very beneficial.
So certainly, go ahead.
The VA does a good job in treating their patients. Sometimes the bureaucracy gets frustrating. So there's some positives that the VA has, but because of the great distance patients have to travel sometimes for treatment, I think having contracts at local hospitals would be a real good idea. Thank you.
James, thanks so much for the call. You are with us for a week in review as we break down top stories of the week, better understand the issues from differing political perspectives. Rick Essenberg is president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Ed Flone with us as well, associate professor of law at Marquette University. Your insights on the week's developments, 800-642-1234. What do you make of the Commerce Department's decision to add a citizenship status question? How about House Speaker Paul Ryan? Is he staying? Is he going? What do you think? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be right back for more discussion in just a moment on the Ideas Network. And you're with us for Week in Review, Wisconsin Style. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Rick Essenberg is President General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Ed Filone, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University. You can join the roundtable at 800-642-1234. We heard speculation this week that House Speaker Paul Ryan may or may not be going after his seat. We'll explore that with our guests. And what developments caught your attention this week? Call in 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's look this week to the Commerce Department announcing adding a question asking about citizenship to the 2020 census. In a memo, the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said the Justice Department requested this to help determine possible violations of the Voting Rights Act. But critics are saying the move expresses anti-immigrant sentiment. So first, Rick, what do you make of this move this week?
Well, I think that, again, there's the issue and then there's the subtext around the issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we had a challenge to the maps in the state of Wisconsin after the 2011, the initial challenge to the maps after the 2011 redistricting, there was only one part of the plaintiff's case that was successful. And that part had to do with redrawing the boundaries of Assembly District 8 in the south side of Milwaukee. The reason that the court concluded that the legislature had gotten it wrong is that in attempting to comply with the Voting Rights Act and creating a district in which Hispanic voters would have an opportunity to elect the candidate of their choice, they used the total Hispanic population of Assembly District 8. And the court said, you can't do that. You have to use Hispanic citizen voting population because only citizens can vote. And therefore, you have to have the requisite supermajority of Hispanic citizens in order to comply with the Voting Rights Act. And, of course, they had to essentially estimate what that number was. And so it's absolutely true that citizenship matters with respect to the Voting Rights Act, or at least so far the United States Supreme Court and courts of appeals have held. Beyond that, it seems to me that there's a question here about whether citizenship matters. Do we believe in open borders? Do we believe that that there should be some type of distinction between citizens and non-citizens? If we believe that there ought to be, then it makes sense to track, you know, how many citizens we have. And it's a question that we've asked before. It's been asked, I think it was asked in the long-form census between 1970 and 2000. It's recently been asked in the American Community Survey, and I don't think that the results of asking the question show that people are any less likely to respond to the question. I think the American Community Survey has a response rate which is, you know, just as high as some of these other census instruments. And so I think that we've got a red herring here, a suggestion that people will not respond to the survey without any evidence to establish that that's so. And then I think we have a subtext here which revolves around the issue of whether or not we think it matters that someone is a citizen or not. If we think it matters, then I think there's no reason not to track that in our census numbers.
Well, Ed, a bunch of states are suiting up on this in the days after this announcement. What are you watching for here?
Well, first of all, let me say I disagree with just about everything Rick said in that response. I think that the danger is conflating two separate issues here. One is the constitutional obligation to collect data, which is what the census is about. And then there's the other question of, well, what happens with that data? How is it used in various contexts by the government? That's a wholly separate issue. It should have nothing to do with what data you collect. The Constitution requires an enumeration of all persons. Since the 1950s, we have not asked individuals in the full census to declare their citizenship status.
We could. There's no bar on doing it. But since the 1950s, we haven't. Instead, it's been asked in a second survey document that goes to a smaller segment of the population. So what we have here is a rather sudden, abrupt, last minute in the final stages of preparation change to insert this, and a change that has, you know, reinstitutes something that has not been in there since the 1950s. And so when you have this sudden change going back so many years into the past to resurrect the question, it naturally raises a concern. Why? Why now? Why so sudden? And I think there is a great deal of evidence that, including questions about citizenship status, deters non-citizens from responding. They don't want to answer that question, and therefore you don't get any information on the number of non-citizens. And again, the Constitution requires an enumeration of all persons. And it's not a question of whether citizenship matters in our society. It's a question that we need to know how many people there are, and then we need to figure out when and if that information is relevant for different purposes. So,
do you see more states fighting back on this by filing lawsuits?
Well, again, it's a question. If blue states are undercounted, then that has negative implications for blue states. And so, just like the Tax Reform Act, we see a deliberate adoption of policies that would have a greater impact on heavily Democratic states. You really have to question, you know, I thought when you got elected to the national government, certainly in the executive branch, that you represented the entire country and not just people of your political party. So, again, this is yet another instance of a policy position that only benefits or greatly benefits one party over another.
We'll keep watching that. Let's move on here. This week, U.S. Representative Mark Amadei of Nevada said on a Nevada-based political news show that Speaker Paul Ryan is on his way out. Let's listen.
The rumor mill is Paul Ryan's getting ready to resign in the next 30 to 60 days and that Steve Scalise will be the new speaker. Now, that's interesting because nobody's talked to members how they're going to vote, or maybe they've talked to all the members but me. So I don't know. That's the rumor mill last week.
Well, that rebuttal, those remarks came with a rebuttal from Ryan's aides, who said the speaker is not resigning. Former speakers Eric Cantor and John Boehner also weighed in, saying it's ludicrous, preposterous. And this isn't the first time there's been speculation about Speaker Ryan's future. So, Rick, any thoughts on this latest rumor and what the representative was getting there?
I don't know. I think that if Ryan wasn't going to run for re-election, we know that by now. He's going to run for re-election. Whether or not he stands for the speakership or not, may turn on what happens in the fall election. It's plausible to imagine that Ryan, who's always wanted to spend more time with his family and was very reluctant to accept the speakership in the first place, because of those concerns, might decide, particularly if the elections don't go well for the Republicans, that he's no longer willing to make the sacrifice that he makes to serve as Speaker in an environment where he's unlikely to accomplish anything. This is particularly true since, he may well regard the tax reform bill as a capstone accomplishment of the speakership. If it doesn't go that way, then I think it becomes a more calculated, a more difficult calculus for him, because I think he has been interested in entitlement reform in the past. That's very difficult right now. The president doesn't seem to have any interest in that. But I can imagine Ryan deciding to stay on as Speaker if he thought that the environment was such following the fall election that entitlement reform might be on the table. But I don't think we're going to know until after November.
Ed Filone, any insights here pre-November?
Well, I don't have a lot of sympathy for Paul Ryan. I think that he's obviously been forced to abandon some of what were his supposed core principles, the idea that government deficits matter and the government shouldn't run huge budget deficits. He's had to abandon that principle. The idea that governments should not use the eminent domain power to take private homes and hand them over to private developers, you had to abandon that. The Foxconn development is in his district or affects his district. The idea that we as a society should not be demonizing lawful immigrants, he's abandoned now and sat quietly by while the Trump administration demonizes immigration across the board. And so to a certain extent, anyone who's the leader of a party may have to modify their positions due to their leadership in a way that alienates them somewhat from their own district. There's always a risk that your political obligations cause you to move away from the feelings of your district and you get punished at election time. But I see kind of almost a Shakespearean tragedy here of someone who finds themselves now wielding such power but not being able to do the things they believe in because of the Trump administration. I have no sympathy for him. It's just interesting to observe.
Let's round out the hour with some of the diplomats being expelled. President Trump ordered the closure of the Russian consulate in Seattle by this coming Monday, along with the expulsion of 60 Russian officers from the U.S. And now Russia is expelling 60 American diplomats. This comes the week after the president congratulated President Putin on his reelection. So, Rick, what kind of messages do you think are going on here to the allies amidst these decisions to expel these diplomats on Russia's behalf and on the U.S.'s behalf?
Well, I think that the one of the officials from Moscow probably put it best. It's tit for tat. It's sort of interesting to me to note that folks are generally willing to assume that the Trump administration is in Putin's back pocket. But if you look at a lot of the things that the administration has actually done, as opposed to whether or not Trump has tweeted the right things or not made phone calls that people didn't want him to make or failed to say the thing that people want him to say. If you look at the policies that have been adopted, the situation is far more complicated. And in this situation, there was apparently credible evidence of misconduct by the Russians with respect to the poisoning of an individual in the United Kingdom. And there was a concerted effort on the part of Western democracies and others to respond to that.
And I'm gonna have to break.
The administration participated in that.
Well, I got to break in here. And Ed, you have like about 15 seconds. Any insights here as you see these expulsions?
Expulsions are a sideshow. What's important is that the British government has generated a coalition of nations to follow, and the next step is banking restrictions on Russian nationals, travel restrictions on Russian nationals, those kinds of economic sanctions. If they keep that coalition together, puts incredible pressure on the U.S. to follow.
And thank you so much, both of you. Rick Essenberg is President General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Ed Filone there, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University. This edition of Week in Review was produced by Brianne Chasseau and Executive Producer Michelle Johnson. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here Monday.